this is Jeff Blankfort, welcoming you to the June 13th edition of Takes on the World, a program on international affairs that comes your way the second and fourth Wednesdays of each month and every other fifth Wednesday when I open the phones to get your takes on the world. Before getting on with today's program, I wish to thank once again those of you who pledge your support to Takes on the World and for Joy LeClaire's forthright radio on May 23rd that enabled us to exceed our goal for that hour and inspire us to keep bringing you the kind of programming that you're not likely to hear on any other radio station. Those of you who missed the opportunity to make your pledge that day can still do so by going to kzyx.org and pressing on that red donate button. It's actually a rectangle at the top of the page. Thank you, and now on to today's program. Now, when it comes to the actions and antics of Donald Trump, we can't say he didn't warn us that, if elected, he was going to reshape America's relationship with our closest allies, who he accused of abusing us in every way that one country can abuse another short of launching a shooting war. And so he has, first by pulling the U.S. out of the Trans-Pacific Trade Partnership, which many Democrats and labor unions applauded, followed by withdrawing the U.S. from the Paris Climate Agreement, which outside of his xenophobic fan base was greeted with universal disapproval. As promised, he began renegotiating NAFTA, demanding terms from Canada and Mexico more beneficial, in his opinion, to the U.S., then initiating over the last month a trade war with Washington's long-standing allies that could be devastating to America as well as the world's economy. Finally, on Monday, he made an early exit from the G7 meeting in Ottawa after scrapping with fellow Western leaders over trade issues, leaving a trail of insulting tweets as he hopped over to Singapore to have his historic one-on-one with North Korea's Kim Jong-un, the outcome of which is too early to do more than speculate. In sum, after a year and a half in office, President Trump has succeeded in what critics from liberals to neocons complain is upending the post-1945 U.S.-dominated world order, alienating the U.S. from its closest allies in a way that can only bring smiles to the face of Russian President Vladimir Putin. In the Middle East, Putin has a lot to thank Trump for, was the headline of Robert Fisk's May 29th column in the Independent of London. In that lengthy article, Fisk, the dean of Middle East correspondence, describes how Trump's decisions have opened the door for what can be seen as a successful charm offensive by the Russian leader, who manages to maintain good relations with the heads of state of every country in the region, even those who are sworn enemies of one another. At 15 minutes past the hour, I'll be speaking with Robert Fisk for 20 minutes about his article, Web, that is Middle Eastern Politics Today, after which I'll conclude my commentary, so stay tuned for that. Until then, I'm going to focus on a subject which has long been more subject to distortion by the U.S. media than any other, namely the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. It has been predictably delinquent in its reporting of Israel's response to the weekly March of Return protests by thousands of Gazans over the last 2 months that have seen more than 150 Palestinians killed by Israeli sniper fire, with thousands more wounded. Having no correspondence actually the scene of the shooting, most of the U.S. media, like our political class, has relied on the press statements of Israel's propaganda ministry, which places blame for all the deaths and injuries on Hamas. Consequently, you will not find any mention of reports such as that on June 6 in the prestigious British medical journal BMJ by Nafees Abu Shaban, head of plastic and reconstructive surgery at Gaza's Shifa Hospital, in which he describes in detail the effect of the special bullets that the Israeli snipers lying safely behind dirt berms have used on unarmed protesters. Quote, "The humanitarian agency Médecins Sans Frontières, that's Doctors Without Borders, has been operating in Gaza," he writes, "and says that the people have been shot with bullets that have caused fist-sized wounds of unusual severity." Marie Elizabeth Angra, head of MSF Palestine, says in their report that, quote, "half of the more than 500 patients we have admitted in our clinics have injuries where the bullet has literally destroyed tissue after having pulverized bone." And these patients, she wrote on Médecins Sans Frontières website in April, 2 months ago, before the numbers of the wounded greatly expanded, quote, "will need to have very complex surgical operations, and most of them will have disabilities for life. That is what we are facing," writes Dr. Abu Shaban. I have seen a great deal of physical trauma in Gaza following Israeli attacks, but have not seen these kind of injuries before. From the appearance of the wounds, concludes Dr. Abu Shaban, there appears to have been systematic use by Israeli Defense Force snipers of ammunition with an expanding butterfly effect. End quote. The international response condemning Israel came in a resolution introduced by Kuwait at a special meeting of the UN Security Council on June 1st, which, as expected, USU Ambassador Nikki Haley vetoed. Haley, in turn, offered her own resolution, placing all the blame on Hamas, making not a single mention of the Palestinian casualties. When it failed to garner a single vote other than her own, Haley lashed out at the Security Council, saying, quote, "It is now completely clear the UN is hopelessly biased against Israel. The United States will not allow such bias, which is why we did not hesitate to cast our veto." A lone voice speaking up for the Palestinians has been Senator Bernie Sanders, but unlike when he was running for president and in the immediate aftermath of elections when he was frequently interviewed, you won't hear much of what he has to say on mainstream media. Back in April, after the first violent Israeli response to the Gazans' march of return, Sanders told CNN that he didn't accept Israel's justification for shooting live ammunition at protesters. Earlier, he had tweeted, quote, that the killing of Palestinian demonstrators by Israeli forces in Gaza is tragic. It is the right of all people to protest for a better future without a violent response. Meanwhile, he added, the situation in Gaza remains a humanitarian disaster. The U.S. must play a more positive role in ending the Gaza blockade and helping Palestinians and Israelis build a future that works for all. But Sanders didn't stop there. Writing in the Jewish Weekly Forward on Monday, Peter Beinart pointed out that while, quote, not many in the media are noticing, but in the shadow of Trump and Benjamin Netanyahu, Bernie Sanders is dramatically challenging Beltway discourse on Israel. Last month, he wrote, Sanders crossed one of the red lines demarcating politically acceptable Washington discourse about Israel. He organized the first letter written by multiple senators criticizing Israel's blockade of the Gaza Strip. Then last week, he raced past that line again with a video that is unlike anything I've ever seen from an American senator. For starters, writes Beinart, it consists entirely of interviews with Palestinians in Gaza. That alone is extraordinary. Palestinians in Gaza are almost never included in the debates on American TV. Palestinians are rarely invited to hold public briefings on Capitol Hill, and when they are, it's hugely controversial. In his video, Beinart goes on, Sanders lets Palestinians from Gaza speak for themselves, and they say things American politicians simply don't say. Again and again, the speakers, who are not politicians but rather academics, students, and journalists, called Gaza a prison. End quote. That's an excerpt from Peter Beinart's article in the June 11th Forward, New York Jewish Weekly, which contains links to Sanders' latest video. In case you may be wondering what has been happening on this issue in our congressional district, there has been a petition circulating on the Roots Action website criticizing the positions of our Representative Jared Huffman. The first issue on the petition deals with Representative Huffman's unwillingness to sign his name to House Resolution 4391, promoting human rights by ending Israeli military detention of Palestinian Children Act. It was introduced by Betty McCollum of Minnesota and is designed to make sure that the military aid the U.S. sends to Israel every year is not used to harm children. The petition goes on, after all the in-person requests, the multiple talks with staff, the hundreds of letters and phone calls, we see no sign he will support it. Congressman Huffman, the petition continued, seems to have given his full support for the shooting of unarmed protesters in Gaza, blaming Palestinians themselves for the actions of Israeli military snipers. When pressed at a public forum on May 11th about his silence on the subject, the petition asserts, Huffman replied by saying, quote, let's talk about Hamas pushing kids into dangerous situations, end quote. A third charge on the petition was that, quote, on May 8th, Huffman signed on to another bill, H.R. 5141, that promises more than $3.8 billion in U.S. aid to the Israeli military with no accountability whatsoever, end quote. On the receipt of the petition, I wrote to Representative Huffman to get his responses. There is not sufficient time to read his entire email, but here are his replies to the particular issues raised, and I probably will continue them after I speak with Robert Fisk. Huffman writes to me, quote, "I am concerned about the treatment of children in Israel, Palestine Authority, Gaza, and everywhere else for that matter. I agree that the U.S. should include this issue as a priority in our relationship with Israel, and I'm looking into an appropriate letter or resolution to voice that concern short of threatening to cut off all foreign aid, the McCollum resolution, which I believe is not a realistic or appropriate response. The core of our disagreement," continued Huffman, "is that I support the State of Israel's right to exist and defend itself against very real and growing security threats that would be hard for most Americans to imagine living with. Those threats," writes Huffman, "are never seriously acknowledged by the anti-Israel groups, who also refuse to acknowledge and consider the abuses and atrocities that occur on the Palestinian side of the conflict. In their very biased framing, there is only one evil villain, Israel, a totally innocent victim, Palestinians, and no nuances or countervailing perspectives. They portray Hamas as a benevolent organizer of a nonviolent protest at the Gaza border. In reality, Hamas is a cynical and ruthless terrorist group that is deliberately lying to and exploiting civilians and children in ways that it knows will get them hurt or killed in hopes of generating useful media coverage," writes Huffman. "And as much as I deplore terrible humanitarian conditions in Gaza, if you stubbornly lay 100% of the responsibility for that on Israel and refuse to discuss Hamas or Egypt, then your conversation is not really about humanitarianism, it's about attacking Israel," end quote. Well, those are the words of our congressional representative, Jared Huffman. And needless to say, I don't agree with his assessment, which seems to be based on the talking points provided by Israel's overactive U.S. lobby. I also must add, whereas he contends that those criticizing Israel's behavior are doing so because they're anti-Israel, the initiator of the petition and very many of the activists who have been foremost among those protesting the Gaza massacre happen to be Jewish, and they are joined in doing so by a small minority of Israeli Jews who object to what Israel is doing in their name. I have extended an invitation, Representative Huffman, to come on Takes on the World and discuss this, other aspects of U.S. foreign policy, and I hope at some point he will respond. There's one particular Israeli, Haaretz columnist Gideon Levy, who I have interviewed on this program, who has not hesitated to unconditionally condemn his country's actions. The latest atrocity which attracted his and the world's attention was the murder of a 21-year-old young woman, Palestinian medic Razan al-Najjar, clearly identified as such by an Israeli sniper. He writes, a few short words, "Razan al-Najjar isn't an angel of mercy," sum up the depths of Israeli propaganda, writes Levy. Avichai Edrei, the Israeli Army's Arabic language spokesman, who also speaks in my name, writes Levy, is a representative of an army of mercy that also now has appointed itself the judge of the measure of mercy in a medic treating Palestinian wounded on Gaza's border with Israel, and who Israeli army soldiers mercilessly killed. After killing her, Levy points out, referring to an army-made video that attempted to link her to Hamas and which was headlined in the New York Times, he says, it was also necessary to assassinate her character. Propaganda is a tool that serves many countries. In Israel, it's called Hasbara, public diplomacy, because why would it need propaganda? Recently, its propaganda has sunk to such despicable lows, writes Levy, that nothing can better prove that its justifications have run out, its excuses gone, the truth is the enemy, and all that's left are lies and slander. A medic in a nursing uniform has been shot to death by Israeli army snipers, as have journalists with press vests and an amputee in a wheelchair. If we rely on Israeli army snipers to know what they are doing, counting on them to be the most accurate in the world, then these people have been shot deliberately, writes Levy. Surely, if the army had believed in the justice of the military campaign that it is waging in Gaza, it would have taken responsibility for these killings, apologizing, expressing regret, and offering compensation. But when the earth is burning under our feet, When we know the truth and understanding that shooting at demonstrators and killing more than 120 of them and rendering hundreds of others disabled is more akin to a massacre, one cannot apologize or express regret. Israel's ambassador in London, Mark Regev, who is another top polished propagandist, writes Levy, was quick to tweet about the, quote, the medical volunteer, in quotation marks, as if a Palestinian could not be a medical volunteer. Instead, Regev wrote, her death is, quote, yet another reminder of Hamas's brutality, end quote. The army kills a medic in a white uniform in an outrageous violation of international law, which provides protection for medical personnel and combat zones. And that's despite the fact that Gaza border does not constitute a combat zone, but it's Hamas that is a brutal one. Kill me, Mr. Ambassador, but who could possibly follow this twisted, sick logic, asked Gideon Levy in Haaretz. I should mention that the May 18th Jewish Weekly Forward carried a story ignored by the mainstream media about an Israeli government-linked crowdsourced propaganda app that was used to successfully manipulate reactions to the Facebook posts on major news outlets following Israel's killing of 60 Palestinians in Gaza. Facebook acknowledged that the app directing its users to, quote, like it, became the top comments on more than a dozen posts from major news outlets about the May 14th shooting, including posts by The Wall Street Journal and CNN. The app, called ACT.IL, IL stands for Israel, is a joint project of Sheldon Adelson's Israeli-American Council and IDC Herzliya, an Israeli university. As The Forward reported last November, it works closely with Israel's intelligence community and its Ministry of Strategic Affairs. Wouldn't you think it should have to register as a foreign agent? Well, when it comes to Israel and its organizations in this country, they get a waiver. We've had a number of people have to register as foreign agents, but all the organizations lobbying for Israel do not have to do that. President John F. Kennedy in 1962 became outraged at some of Israel's behavior, particularly their efforts to hide their atomic weapons program. And he called on the American Zionist Council, which is the predecessor to AIPAC, to register as a foreign agent. And the Justice Department, or his brother Robert, proceeded to do that. But the lawyers for the American Zionist Council obfuscated, delayed until November 22, 1963, when John F. Kennedy was assassinated. And Lyndon Johnson, who at that time became the most pro-Israel president in history, allowed the case to diminish and die. And no U.S. president or no U.S. Justice Department has made an effort to do that since, to force the AIPAC, in this case, to register as a foreign agent, which it clearly is, representing Israel in the United States, and has a tremendous influence over our members of Congress. Kennedy, by the way, also supported the Palestinian right of return, even though he didn't demand that all the Palestinians be allowed to return. He did call for the support of the principle and that at least 100,000 be allowed to return. And at one point, Adlai Stevenson met with Ben-Gurion, the Prime Minister of Israel, and told him, after all, the refugees were Israel's fault and they had to deal with that issue. We don't hear about that at all. And no other U.S. president has ever called or supported the idea of Palestinian right of return. And thirdly, of course, President Kennedy opposed Israel's attempts to get nuclear and to keep them from doing that, he gave them defensive weapons, which were later used to make people believe that President Kennedy was a big supporter of Israel. In fact, if you read Cy Hirsch's Samson Option, after Kennedy became president, and evidently the lobby had helped him win in Illinois, Abe Feinberg, a major behind-the-scenes player for the Democratic Party and for Israel in the United States, came to Kennedy's office and told him, well, we helped get you elected president. Now we want to let you know, we want to tell you what your Middle East policy should be. And Kennedy, after Feinberg left the office, came out and was raging, furious to the staff members. Feinberg was also the one who, when President Harry Truman was running for office and was short of money for his railroad trip around the country, Feinberg was the one who came and put a large envelope that contained maybe $2 million in his pocket. And even Kennedy used to tell that story. A little history, which you're not going to find anywhere else. Before I conclude this segment, you recall you've heard a lot in the past week, have been reading and hearing eulogies to the famed chef and TV host Anthony Bourdain, whose program Parts Unknown took him to kitchens all over the world, who reportedly committed suicide in the Paris hotel room. What you haven't read or heard is about his visit to Gaza for Parts Unknown. You may have seen that, though. In which he met with people and learned about the food they loved as well as the problems caused by Israel's suffocating occupation. For this, he was recognized with an award from the Muslim Public Affairs Council, where he made the following brief acceptance speech, which I'm going to play for you now.
I'm very, very honored for this award, the Impact Voices of Courage and Conscience Media Award. There was, however, very little courage, and one would hope an ordinary amount of conscience at work in producing our Israel-Palestine episode of Parts Unknown. I was enormously grateful for the response from Palestinians in particular, for doing what seemed to me an ordinary thing, something we do all the time, show regular people doing everyday things, cooking and enjoying meals, playing with their children, talking about their lives, their hopes, and dreams. It is a measure, I guess, of how twisted and shallow our depiction of a people is that these images come as a shock to so many. The world has visited many terrible things on the Palestinian people, none more shameful than robbing them of their basic humanity. People are not statistics. That is all we attempted to show. A small, pathetically small step towards understanding. Be recognized in this way means a lot to me and to all of us who worked on the show. For that, I thank you from the bottom of my heart. Thanks.
Anthony Bourdain speaking about his trip to Gaza. And unfortunately, you didn't hear that anywhere or read that anywhere. And his passing is indeed a sad one. He contributed a lot. And if you ever watched his show, which I did at other people's homes, because I don't actually have television, I found it very enjoyable and very interesting the way he interacted with people in a very, I don't want to use the word humble, but in a certain humble way. This is Jeff Blankfort. Thanks for listening.